Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things that everyone's passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics.
And this week, our nation celebrated Darwin Day, the 200th anniversary of the birthday of a man whose seminal ideas on the origins of species changed modern science and really the world. His claim for original universal descent, that all living creatures descended from one original life form, remains very controversial, especially in our nation's classrooms. Our Texas State School Board will soon begin discussing whether this particular claim of original universal descent should receive more attention and instruction in our state schools. So the controversy continues. And last week, and again this week, our contribution to Darwin Day is to interview two authors and scientists who hold some different views on Darwin's ideas. Last week, we interviewed Dr. Carl Giverson on his book, Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. Dr. Giverson received his PhD from Rice University in Houston and teaches physics at Eastern Nazarene College in Maine. He's also director of the Forum on Faith and Science at Gordon College, and he'll be with us again today. With us also last week and today is Dr. Paul Nelson, a philosopher of science who received his PhD from the University of Chicago. Dr. Nelson teaches at Biola University in Los Angeles, and this week we'll focus on a new textbook that Dr. Nelson has co-authored, Exploring Evolution, The Arguments For and Against Neo-Darwinism. And Dr. Giverson and Dr. Nelson are both with us to offer these two different perspectives on Dr. Nelson's book. We focused on Dr. Giverson's book this last week, so this week we'll focus on Explore Evolution. And our goal remains to give two distinguished authors on two sides of the Darwinian evolution controversy the opportunity to speak about their own book and respond to the other's book and ideals.
And gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Well, good. Thank you. We're so glad to have you. Paul and Carl, what do you make of this week's celebration of Darwin's Day? Are you throwing a little confetti, tipping your hats?
Actually, I'm giving a lecture at Willow Creek Church here in Chicago, which is a very large church in the western suburbs, on what Darwin got right.
Oh.
I'm going to be talking about various insights of Darwin that I think make sense from a biblical perspective, mainly having to do with the problem of evil. So I'm going to surprise people and talk about what I thought Darwin got right, although I think he might have gone the wrong direction from some of his insights.
Yeah.
I agree with your opening comment. He had a significant, probably unparalleled influence on Western culture for the past 150 years. So however one comes down on the question of Darwin, it's hard to ignore him.
And Carl, what about you?
Well, I'm going to be giving two lectures at Azusa Pacific University today on Darwinism and its influence and how Christians can think about that. So I'll also be talking about things that I think Darwin got right, but my list might be a little longer than Paul's.
Okay. Well, Paul, I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book, Explore Evolution, The Arguments For and Against Neo-Darwinism. I'm not a science person, but I found it very easy to follow and even very conversational. Who are you inviting to explore evolution in this book, and what do you offer them?
Well, the book is written mainly for upper-level high school students and beginning college students. It's set about at that level, or interested lay people.
Yeah, or their parents, yeah.
Or parents, right. Yeah. And the idea is to explore both the strengths and weaknesses, to use a phrase familiar to Texans, of standard evolutionary theory, the theory as it's put forward in high school and college biology textbooks. We want to acquaint students or acquaint readers generally with some lines of evidence that don't often receive attention in textbooks, but which are very, very important. And we want to encourage debate. I think science comes alive when students are presented with open questions and unsolved problems. And certainly when one looks at the history of science and the biographies of great scientists, they fell in love with their subject when they found its open questions, its unanswered problems.
Yeah.
So that's what we want to encourage.
And you invite the reader to look at the evidence and listen to the arguments and think for yourself. But here's my question. Do you think that high school students, early college students, even parents, the general adult audience that hasn't really read widely about the subject of Darwinian evolution, do you think that they can actually reach an informed opinion about a subject this complex and technical?
Well, obviously there are going to be technical questions that at certain levels that can really only be adequately addressed with graduate education. But we try in the book to present the evidence in a way that is accurate. In other words, we don't distort the evidence, but that leaves it accessible for someone with a reasonable background in biology. I would not use this book as an introductory biology text. It's meant for students who have, I would say, 2 or 3 years of science, in particular, have a full year of high school biology already behind them. And furthermore, I would expect that those students should have already learned a great deal about evolutionary theory.
Okay.
So, for instance, my own older daughter is taking AP Biology right now using a college text, and this book would be appropriate for her. You know, she's had fairly significant scientific background, so I think she is able, actually, to evaluate these arguments.
Okay. And, Carl, how would you respond?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with Paul that the excitement of science comes from the fact that it's filled with unanswered questions, and some of the most interesting science writing involves articulating what these questions are, the things that we don't know, and how deep the mysteries are. But I think that the explore evolution approach is locating those controversies in the wrong place. I mean, the book, I think, misleads students into thinking that there's a big constituency within the scientific community that's kind of not on board with Darwin and evolution. And I think if a student had this approach in their education through high school, through college, and then they went away to graduate school to study biology, they would be very surprised to discover that this constituency that is opposed to evolution doesn't exist. I mean, at very few graduate schools in the country would you find any of the people that are routinely referred to in this book as Darwin's critics and people who dispute the theory and so on. I mean, that's a very small, tiny number of people, but the book represents it as if it's kind of a big constituency within the scientific community. And so I don't think that's where the interesting questions in evolutionary biology reside.
One of the themes of the book is that within evolutionary biology itself, there are significant disagreements, for instance, about the role of natural selection. And we're careful in the book to explain that the scientists we cite and discuss, many of them do not reject evolution in the very most general sense of change over time or some notion of common ancestry. But speaking from my own experience as a student of evolutionary biology, both as an undergraduate and graduate student, one cannot avoid going, when one goes to a biology meeting, very heated debates within evolutionary theory about quite significant questions, such as one that you alluded to, Lael, at the beginning of the program: is there a single tree of life? And I think it does a disservice to students to present evolutionary theory to them in a way that makes it seem more unanimous than in fact it is.
I guess the question would be, if the general science curriculums never raise these issues or rarely raise these issues because of the small number of scientists that are asking them, is there a place for a book that raises these issues in a significant way and looks at the evidence behind them? And at least, even if the scientists may be in the minority, bring substantive questions to the table, and I guess, you know, a lot of people would find a great deal of interest in that. Well, let's move on. You mentioned, you know, what we mean when we say evolution, and I couldn't help but think that just this past week, I read a piece in the Houston Chronicle about Darwin Day, and a scientist remarked that Oh, goodness. After all the evidence, people still reject the ideal of the idea of universal common descent, the idea that all life forms came from one original life form. And he found it, quote, laughable, unquote. And he said that it's just, you know, evolution is so helpful and convincing in its, you know, as a scientific theory. But then it was interesting because all the examples that were given subsequent to that quote were very different than the idea of universal original descent. They were much more about the small changes over time that we can see in a lab, like bacteria becoming resistant to certain medicines. And I can understand scientists' frustration over people who say they don't believe in evolution, when that sort of mutation and natural selection and change is so observable in the lab. But the interesting thing was that nothing else in the rest of the article spoke to the question of whether a reptile can become a bird. And that is something we cannot observe in a lab. So it seems that there's a great confusion over what evolution means. So how have you approached that in your book, Paul?
Well, in the opening chapters, we tried to distinguish multiple senses of the word evolution. One of them you've already mentioned, namely adaptation to environmental circumstances. There's no question that there's abundant evidence for species adapting, let's say, to the presence of a toxin in their environment by the mechanism or the process of natural selection. So that's one sense of evolution. Another, however, is Darwin's grand tree, the idea that there was a single common ancestor to all living things as we know it, deep in the history of life on Earth. And then there's also the sense of evolution meaning simply change over time, that the biota of Earth has changed dramatically over its history. There aren't any dinosaurs anymore, for instance. So it's important that students grasp that evolution, that word, can mean multiple things, and that one can have strong evidence for one part of the theory or one aspect of evolution and yet lack evidence for another part.
So yeah, it makes you wonder why they haven't come up with two general terms to make the distinction. Carl, how would you respond? Would you agree that evolution used in a broad way like this is kind of confusing to a lot of people?
Well, I think it's confusing partly because of the polemics that surrounded it, as people say exactly what you just said, that talking about how a bacteria might evolve in response to medication is hardly an argument that all life forms originated from a single cell, and that kind of has a common sense ring to it. But the difficulty, though, has to do with what kind of inferences you can reasonably draw from things which are occurring at a rate that we can watch. And we can't see the way things change over millions of years. We can't see that at all. We can only see things changing over a few weeks or years, and then we have to infer the rest. And to say that there's no connection between those two would be something like watching a child for 3 hours in the afternoon and saying, they're not getting any taller. So what's the basis for this claim that people grow several feet over the course of their life? Well, I mean, that would seem absurd, because you would say, well, gee, you only watch them for 3 hours. It doesn't occur on that scale. So if you extrapolate the scales and say, okay, we can watch a bacteria change over 7 years of observation, so what might happen over 700 million years? Well, we can't quite imagine that, but the extrapolation is not unreasonable, and the kind of evidences that we invoke in that case can't be based on the fact that we have watched these things and observed them. We have to go back and look for different kinds of evidence. So I think it's kind of disingenuous to kind of say, well, we can't extrapolate these changes. Well, of course we can't, because we observe for a few years, but we have a theory which stretches over billions of years.
May I respond to that?
Okay, briefly, we want to get something in before the break.
We address this question of extrapolation in the book. One can imagine watching a pine tree grow at a certain rate and saying, well, look, over 5,000 years, it'll be, you know, 500 feet or 1,000 feet tall. Extrapolation can be a very tricky game. It all depends on what the data support. And within evolutionary theory, there are great debates about whether microevolution can be extrapolated to explain macroevolution.
Yeah. Okay, just briefly, we've got just about a minute before the break here. Paul, would you characterize your book as a book on intelligent design?
No. In fact, we were scrupulous to keep it focused on evolutionary theory itself. Intelligent design is, I think, at this point, much too young a theory to be taught in public schools. I think it needs to grow up a little bit, develop its explanatory power. And we wanted to talk about evolutionary theory itself, its strengths and weaknesses, to use that familiar phrase, because there's plenty there to occupy a bright student just on that topic itself.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. This has been great to have Dr. Carl Garverson and Dr. Paul Nelson, both respected scientists and authors that deal with Darwinian evolution from different perspectives, celebrating Darwin Day this week on The Things That Matter Most. We'll be back in a moment.
Hey.
Lael?
Yeah.
May I request that you not refer to me as a scientist? My PhD is in philosophy.
Oh, that's right. Thank you so much. I will make that correction. Thank you. I noted that at some point.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off because we have three ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes, so without any effort, you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. Three ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Lael Arrington.
And Rick Davis.
And before we get back to our guests, we'd like to talk to you about our show for a minute.
Yeah, for almost 4 years now, The Things That Matter Most has brought you a unique show that offers variety and in-depth coverage of spiritual viewpoints that you really can't find anywhere else.
We've been so pleased to bring you top experts, New York Times best-selling authors, hopefully more light than heat, in a respectful dialogue about the things that matter most, origins, meaning, morality, purpose, probing the answers to the big questions of life. How do we live and love well with a coherent and a consistent worldview?
We also offer all our shows archived on iTunes or our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where you may listen or download for free.
And where else can you hear great conversations, movie reviews, discussions of what you believe and why you believe it, with guests as diverse as militant atheist Sam Harris and VeggieTales creator Phil Vischer, Saturday Night Live comedian Julia Sweeney, Human Genome Project director Francis Collins.
In order to continue to bring you interesting interviews, opportunities to think about the things that matter most, and because of the tightening economy, our hope is that we can raise some listener support. We have a loyal listenership and hope to raise enough money to stay on the air through this difficult time.
And we're a local organization, lean and mean. We're not this big, huge organization, but our future funding is a little uncertain at this time.
So, too, you, our listeners, we're looking for ongoing or one-time funding to be able to continue the show. We are a tax-deductible nonprofit organization.
So if you could help us out, please contact us at info@thethingsthatmattermost.org and correspond with us, and we'll give you the details.
And as always, thanks for listening. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we have guests that help you decide what you think is true about the most important questions of life. And gentlemen, welcome back to the second segment of our interview.
We're talking with philosopher of science, Paul Nelson, co-author of a textbook, Explore Evolution, The Arguments for and Against Neo-Darwinism, and Dr. Carl Giverson, whose book we focused on last week, Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution.
Okay. Now, Carl, let's go back to the book that we talked, that you wrote, called Saving Darwin, that we talked about primarily last week. And you make the point, and truthfully, I didn't go back in preparation for this interview and find the exact words, but I remember clearly that the position that you take is there are, well, you've said it actually in this interview already today, there are very few serious credentialed scholars that subscribe to intelligent design. Now, do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, it may have something to do with the books I read and the people in my circle of influence. However, I would add parenthetically that I consider it part of my job and on the role that I have in the show. I do read the other side. And the position that you took didn't really, I guess I'm not saying it's not accurate because you would know better than I do, but it didn't hit me as accurate. I could have agreed that there are more credentialed scholars and scientists who support Darwinian evolution and subscribe to intelligent design. But this position that, the way I feel about it when you portray it is that you would have to look long and hard to find a serious scholar who gives credibility to intelligent design. And so I either want to correct myself and get my thinking right on that or take that position. So, Paul, how about you commenting on that first, and then, Carl, if you would comment, that'd be great.
Well, I think I agree with Carl that the relative numbers strongly favor some form of evolution, whether Darwinian or not. The problem with that, however, is that in the history of science, all new theories begin with small populations, sometimes a population of one. Darwin, for instance, was very much alone in the mid-19th century advocating his naturalistic view of evolution, but he managed to persuade most of his peers. I don't think that we can conduct science as a game of counting noses. Truth is not something that's up for polling. So while I would agree with Carl that the majority of the scientific community accepts Darwinian evolution, a sizable minority does not. And health in science, the path to truth comes from open debate. So I guess I just disagree fundamentally with the premise that what we ought to do is count noses.
For a minute, I thought you might beg the question here, but you've circled back and responded. You've used the term sizable minority. That's what I would have said. I would have said 8%. I mean, if you had to put a number on 6%, 8%, 3%, 11%, but not like you could go around the scientific community for 2 years and interact with a bunch of people, and boy, you may never run across anybody who subscribes to intelligent design. And that, Carl, is sort of what I took from your book. I mean, that was sort of the mental picture I got from the words that you wrote. So would you respond to that question?
Yeah, what I would say is that if you subscribe to the top, let's say, 50 leading scientific publications for 2 years, and you looked for an article in one of those publications that was written from the perspective of intelligent design, you would very likely find zero articles in 2 years in the top 50.
Okay, I have to jump in here, though, because those of us that follow this controversy, Carl, all know what happens when you do submit an article for peer review. You can't make it in, and if in the case of Stephen Meyer, who did get his published in the Smithsonian, if you do get it, then there is quite a great deal of resistance within the scientific community to keep the door shut and that will never happen again. Wouldn't you say that may influence the number of articles in peer-reviewed journals?
Well, that's a claim that has great rhetorical value and is often made in debates on this. But when that proposal was, that claim was discussed in one of the court cases, the intelligent design community was asked to produce the rejected articles which had been peer-reviewed and sent back because they had the wrong perspective, and they couldn't produce any. So there's no history of this. It sounds like it could be true, but there's no history of that. There's no list of articles that had been rejected because they were intelligent design articles.
That must mean, see if I have this right, Let me challenge that thinking a little bit, Carl. That means every intelligent design article has been published.
No, that means that intelligent design articles have not been written.
Okay, and how would you respond, Paul?
Well, there's a funny paradox about this. It's very easy to publish articles in the peer-reviewed literature critical of intelligent design. In fact, in the very best journals. A couple of years ago, Nature, for instance, published a major paper arguing that irreducibly complex systems could be produced by Darwinian mechanisms, challenging the very view defended by Michael Behe. A week doesn't go by that I don't see a paper in a major journal taking up critically some argument from intelligent design. So you can get the articles into print if you attack intelligent design. And there's a historical parallel here. Darwin first learned about the idea of evolution from reading criticism of Lamarck as a young man on the Beagle. So ideas often enter the scientific literature first via their critics. So I think intelligent design is making its way into the scientific literature, and what's happening is we're hearing one half of the debate, the critical side. So it's perfectly possible to publish papers on intelligent design as long as you criticize it.
But where are the articles, though? I mean, if these articles are being rejected in the peer review process, then we ought to have a stack of them somewhere where you could say, here, Your Honor, is Exhibit A is a stack of 12 articles rejected by major journals because they're ID articles, and that we don't have that.
Well, actually, I have to disagree with you about that, Carl. I was privy to, firsthand, to the submission of a paper to the Journal of Molecular Evolution. One of the editors is a faculty person at University of Chicago. And I'll cut to the chase. What happened was Mike Behe submitted a paper to that journal. It went into peer review, and the referee said, this paper is unacceptable because it does not advance the current Darwinian paradigm. That was his bottom line for rejecting the paper. I think that when the history of this period is written, we're going to see this funny pattern that the idea of intelligent design will first appear in the scientific literature via its critics, and eventually what will happen is pro-design articles, because of their quality, will begin to appear. In fact, this is happening already. Just last year, a paper was published in a major journal from the Public Library of Science by my colleague Doug Axe at Biologic Institute. A design paper. So it's going to happen. It's just taking a little while.
Okay. Well, we do want to move on to the actual discussion of the evidence itself. Paul, please tell our audience, what are the two main claims that Charles Darwin made that are the focus of your book, Explore Evolution, The Arguments For and Against Neo-Darwinism, meant as a supplemental text to students who are studying biology, who have a little background, as well as the average layperson. Very easy to follow.
Well, the first major claim is universal common ancestry, the idea that there is a single tree of life rooted in a common ancestor in the distant past. The second is the creativity of natural selection, that tree of life was built mainly, not exclusively, but mainly by the process of natural selection acting on random variation. Those are the two big claims.
Okay, let's go to the first one, the universal common descent. What are the five lines, and just toss them off, okay? What are the five lines of argument for and against universal common descent that you discuss in your book?
Well, the first is fossils, a pattern of succession in the fossil record. The second is anatomical homology, similarities in the level of bone structure, for instance, among different kinds of organisms. The third is molecular similarity or molecular homology, similarities at the level of genes and proteins. The fourth is embryology, the patterns we see in development, and that would refer now here exclusively to animals. And the last is biogeography, the distribution of plants and animals around the globe. Those arguments come out of Darwin and then find their way into biology textbooks.
Okay. Back to fossils. Fossils, fossils, fossils. So much of the evolution intelligent design debate seems, at least to a layperson like me, at least in the popular literature, to center on whether or not there are or aren't transitional fossils. So let's settle this once and for all so we don't need to talk about it anymore. Paul, would you please explain, first of all, to our listeners who don't do this full time like you guys do, what is meant by traditional, well, you already said what's meant by traditional fossils. Touch on that and then describe the controversy. And then, Paul, your opinion on whether or not we do or don't have a convincing number of transitional fossils. And then we'll probably go to a break, and then, Carl, we'll hear from you about that after the break. So, Paul, go ahead.
Well, the concept of a transitional fossil means a form found in the fossil record that seems to fall or appears to be intermediate between two other kinds of animals or plants, as
right.
the case may be.
Like an animal that's half bird and half reptile.
Well, putting it very bluntly, I guess you could say that. I think more precisely it would be a creature that has some of the features of birds and some of the features in this case, actually, it would be dinosaurs, not reptiles, strictly speaking.
Okay.
This has been, going back to Darwin, a major area of debate. Are there enough of these forms to satisfy the requirements of Darwin's theory?
And would you please settle this debate once and for all?
I can't.
Are there lots of transitional fossils? Come on.
Well, look. My own view is that when you take in the full range of the history of life, going back to the very earliest fossils we have of single-celled organisms all the way up to Homo sapiens, I think that there are major discontinuities in the history of life that haven't been filled in and that probably will not be filled in. Having said that, there are many instances where there appear to be what one would call transitions. But I have a problem myself with the very concept of transitional form. But I'm not sure we can take
right.
the time to go into that.
Yeah, I just wanted your comment on the fossil record itself.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, it's time to take a break.
Yes,
and maybe
it is.
When we come back, we can get Carl's opinion on the same subject. This is Leah Learington.
And Rick Davis.
And we're discussing the book Explore Evolution in honor of Darwin Day. We'll be back in a moment.
Did you know that 1 out of 15 Americans goes to prison during their lifetime? Many inmates come to prison as proven entrepreneurs, having run successful enterprises such as drug rings and gangs. They're passionate, intelligent, and willing to take risks. Even the most unsophisticated drug dealers understand business concepts like competition, profitability, and risk management. What if these influential business leaders in the criminal world were equipped to run legitimate companies? The Prison Entrepreneurship Program, or PEP, provides inmates nearing release with values-based entrepreneurial training, enabling them to productively reenter society. To make sure that we're not taking old dope dealers and equipping them to just become better dope dealers, we have a rigorous screening process to ensure that they're committed to personal transformation. My name is Catherine Rohr, and I'm the founder and executive director of PEP. I left behind a career in venture capital and private equity in New York City to take on this mission in Texas in 2004. In just 3 years, PEP has produced unparalleled results with our 300 graduates, an employment rate of 98%, a return to prison rate of only 1.6%, and the launch of 36 entrepreneurial businesses. We not only teach these former inmates to be successful, but also to give back to their communities. We're proud to say that 30% of PEP's donors are its own graduates. We've also recruited 800 senior business executives and MBA students from 12 programs, including Harvard and Stanford, to provide hands-on assistance to graduates. This is all in only 3 years. PEP is the only program of its type nationally, and its groundbreaking work has been featured in NBC Nightly News, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Entrepreneur Magazine, and Texas Monthly. Crime is everybody's problem, including yours. You might think that inmates get locked up and stay locked up, but the reality is that 95% of inmates are released from prison back into our communities. I'm inviting you to do something about it. You have everything that PEP needs to make a difference: your financial resources, contacts, and expertise. So how can you get involved? You can give, come to prison with us, you can become a mentor or help our release graduates. For more information, go to www.pep.org. That's pep.org.
Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we finally solve the controversy of whether Darwinian evolution is true or not. No, not true. This is actually the show where we talk about the most important questions of life. Okay, so Carl, before the break, we were asking Paul, who has written a great textbook, but unfortunately has not definitively solve this question of the fossil record. So perhaps you could do that for us, please.
Well, the most important thing to understand about the fossil record is that it's incredibly incomplete. It's just a very, very tiny, statistically insignificant number of the animals that have ever lived leave a fossil trace. And there's any number of ways to establish that. I mean, one simple one is to note that there are a lot of animals which are alive today that we know have been here for a very long time, and there's no fossil record whatsoever for them. So we know that animals can live for millions of years and leave no fossil record whatsoever. So what we get is this extremely imperfect sampling. I mean, some people have compared it to traveling at a high speed through a country and taking a snapshot every couple of hours and then trying to rebuild your trip based on something like that. So we've got these very tiny snapshots there. So the fossil record has a sampling problem, very, very few samples, and that doesn't speak for or against this controversy, but it's just something that we have to kind of take on board before we bring expectations to the fossil record. Now, as for the existence of transitional forms at the expense of maybe what we would call the more stable forms, the way we understand speciation today is that an environmental challenge makes a species maladapted, and there needs to be rapid natural selection taking place until a new species that's more adapted to the new environment emerges. So this process of adaptation, where you go from one stable species to another one in a new environment, creates a whole set of intermediates that aren't around for a very long time, and so are thus very unlikely to be discovered in the fossil record. So the prediction of Darwinian evolution is that the nature of speciation mitigates against there being a lot of transitional fossils in the record.
Then we do run into, when you have large numbers of mutations occurring rapidly, macro mutations even, that tends to mitigate against the survival of life forms. So there are some difficulties with that point of view as well. Would you agree?
Yes. Now, we're talking about natural selection becoming much more potent at that point. There's no reason to suppose that mutations would occur at a greater rate, but natural selection becomes extremely relevant. I mean, when the environment changes, that can make small variations in a species incredibly significant. When the environment is very stable, these small changes are often irrelevant, which is why a stable environment can house an unchanging species for millions of years, but a changing environment can rapidly produce a new species. So that's something which is consistent with various explanations of the origin of life.
You can read more about that in both Paul Nelson's book, Explore Evolution, and you can also read about it. Would you like to suggest another book that deals a little bit more with the evidence, Carl, than your book?
Ken Miller, I think Finding Darwin's God has got a lot of useful information in it, but I also would recommend Francis Collins' Language of God and Daryl Falk's Coming to Peace with Science.
Which is what I want to get to in the next questions, because so many scientists say, okay, we have these similar body plans, skeletal structures, organ alignments, you know, everybody's got a gut. And so if you see all these things, all these living creatures that share the same design, this homology or similarity is cited in your book as evidence for universal common descent of all life forms. And yet it's even taken down to the molecular and the protein level. And it's pointed out at that level. Can you briefly give an example of that in your book, Paul?
Sure. All living things that we know, without exception, use RNA, DNA, and proteins. And it's a remarkable fact that from a heat-loving bacterium in a hot spring in Yellowstone to a blue whale, when you examine their fundamental biochemistry, you will find the same major players, RNA, DNA, and protein. And the argument from that then would be, well, how could this be if these living things didn't share common ancestry? So that would be an argument using molecular data for the single tree picture. In the book, we present that argument as clearly as we can, and then we raise a number of challenges to it.
Right.
I'll mention just one. When I was a student, it was a strong prediction from the theory of common descent that one of the molecular characters that you would find shared by all living things is the same genetic code, meaning the translation table that assigns amino acids to little bits of the nucleic acid code, 64 parts to that code, to put it rather simply. Well, it turns out that the code is not universal. In fact, the National Center for Biotechnology Information now maintains a webpage where they list lots of different codes depending on the organism that one looks at. Well, that's a case of a failed prediction. And when predictions fail, one needs to ask, well, who's to blame? You know, what went wrong? How did this prediction crash and burn? And we look in the book at this prediction of the universality of the genetic code and how it turned out not to be true. And we ask the students to say, what happens when a theory makes a prediction that turns out not to be true? How do you then reassess the theory? And that, to me, is fundamentally the process of science. It's the interaction between our theories and the world. They never quite fit together exactly as nicely as we would like. And science itself grows by finding these problems and going back and looking at theories and reevaluating them.
You know, since you took up this subject in your book, Paul, I was hoping that maybe you might have an opportunity for students to look at some of the genetic evidence that Francis Collins does offer in his book, The Language of God, that that he claims point to this common descent from one living creature. Maybe I could just take a moment to share. He draws several, you know, maybe what you're saying is right. There's not a uniform pattern in all living things. But, for example, he compares the mouse genome with the human genome and points out some very remarkable similarities between the genomes. But I was particularly fascinated by his comparison with the human genome and a chimpanzee genome and saying that, you know, there's one less human genome, and it looks like two of the chimpanzee genomes got combined into one genome because, without getting into the technical details, Collins says that special sequences occur at the tippy end of all primate chromosomes, and that those sequences generally do not occur elsewhere, but that they are found right where evolution would have predicted, in the middle of what they think is that fused chromosome that you find in humans. And you know, you didn't deal with any of these in your book, and so I was just wondering maybe why you didn't. Was the research, you know, not available? Or I mean, obviously, if you really want to make an argument, you go to some of your opponent's toughest evidences for their case, which you have done so beautifully in your book. But that was one of the toughest things in molecular language, and I was disappointed to see that you didn't include it in your book. I was wondering why.
Well, the chronology is that our book was written and off to the printers before Francis Collins' book appeared. I hope that in a later edition of Explore Evolution that we can take up that chromosomal argument, which I agree with you is very powerful.
Because, you know, I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher by profession back in the classroom years ago. And so if I get a kid who has turned in a paper and he's got a misspelling on it, and then the two other kids that sit on either side of him turn in a paper with the same misspelling, then, you know, to me, that is going to scream, okay, there is a cause-effect thing here. They didn't all just happen to have the same misspelling. There's probably a much better chance that the misspelling is related. And so when you see these aberrations in the chromosome, and you know, they're the same from mice to human, or they, you know, they tell a story like this one from the chimpanzee and the human. It's like, okay, this is evidence that demands. Yeah, it's very compelling.
I think that's compelling. Absolutely. I wanted Carl to hear me say that. I'm really trying to be open here.
Yeah.
Yes. No. You've made the case. I mean, that was a point I was hoping would come up, and you've just stated it with great clarity. So yes, I mean, that's absolutely compelling evidence. Knockdown, in my opinion.
Uh huh. And so you're saying that there is evidence out there that, you know, that does raise some questions on that evidence?
Let me put it this way. I think that to evaluate these arguments pro and con, one really needs to get into the details. An example that I can't recall if Collins mentions or not, but other authors do, has to do with vitamin C. Humans, if they don't get enough vitamin C in their diet, develop scurvy. Other primates do as well, chimps and gorillas, for instance. Most other mammals don't. They can make vitamin C. They don't have a problem. Well, when you look at the genes involved in the biosynthesis of vitamin C, there is a defect in the last enzyme in that series that appears to be shared by chimps, humans, gorillas, and other higher primates. So it looks as if, this is one of your molecular mistakes that you mentioned a moment ago, Leo.
The misspelling, that there was a misspelling,
an error, a shared error, that there was a mutation in the common ancestry of the primates, including Homo sapiens, that because we were getting enough fresh fruit, let's say, we're getting enough vitamin C in our diet, we and other primates can survive, and so we just carry the error along. And it's a marker of history, if you will. Now, that would be a powerful argument, and I think it is a powerful argument, for common ancestry. There's a funny extra dimension to the problem, though. It turns out that guinea pigs also have problems with scurvy, not getting vitamin C. My daughter used to have a guinea pig, and the chow that she fed it was rich in vitamin C because it has the same molecular defect. When you align the genes for this particular enzyme in guinea pigs and in Homo sapiens, it turns out that they share many of the same mutations. Now, this turns out to be a puzzle.
And so we're descended from guinea pigs after all.
I've been a guinea
pig
before.
This explains a lot, actually.
Yeah, I have felt like the guinea pig many times.
See, what I would do is put all the evidence in front of a student, a bright student or a bright class of students who are able to follow it, and say, let's sift this pro and con. And in that process, they learn lots of things, how to evaluate molecular similarity, how these kinds of evolutionary arguments are constructed, what would be evidence for or against such an argument. And I think it's healthy for someone like me to be challenged by, for instance, the chromosomal argument you made that Collins features. I don't have an answer for that. But in thinking about it and looking at the data and trying to puzzle it out, I learn more about the world. I learn more about how science works. So I favor lively debate on these topics, and people who favor intelligent design like me ought to be challenged by difficult lines of evidence like the chromosomal pattern that you mentioned.
We're talking about Darwin and Exploring Evolution, Paul Nelson's new book, The Arguments for and Against Neo-Darwinism. And we also have with us Dr. Carl Giverson, author of Saving Darwin, that we interviewed last week. You can find his interview on our website at thethingsthatmattermost.org. Carl, I would just turn to you as we conclude here and say that this discussion critiquing Darwinian evolution has been pretty much on the evidence. We really haven't talked very much about intelligent design. We haven't said anything about God in this interview. Why do you think that so many people tend to categorize intelligent design as creationism? Because, I don't know, as I understand it, creationism begins with the Bible and tries to fit the facts to the evidence, and I don't see that really being a part of this textbook at all.
Some creationism, and the one you've referred to would be called biblical creationism, but all creationism shares the view that a supernatural agency from outside comes into the natural order and accomplishes various things. And the intelligent designer that's implicitly behind the intelligent design movement, everybody knows that this is the Judeo-Christian God. And the intelligent designer.
Although, wait. I'm thinking Paul Berlinski, isn't that his name? I mean, I'm thinking people who are definitely agnostics and, you know, perhaps even atheists that don't subscribe to, you know, that don't have a faith in the Creator God.
Well, if we're going to talk about people like Berlinski, I mean, Berlinski's just a guy having fun in the public eye with this. I mean, he's not thinking seriously about this, but the people who are, like Paul, who thinks very hard and very carefully about it, and Stephen Meyer and Philip Johnson, Dembski, Behe, and so on, those guys all will will state in the appropriate context that it's the Judeo-Christian creator that is the intelligent designer, and it's this supernatural input that is creating the design. And this is so close to traditional creationism that most people don't make a distinction.
But is that fair? What do you think, Paul? Because like you say, we've not even talked about God. It's all been the focus on the evidence, and your book doesn't even mention God. Do you think that that's a fair distinction?
I don't, because I lecture quite a bit internationally on intelligent design. I was in Istanbul, and there were, I think, three Christians in the entire auditorium. The rest of the people were Islamic believers. I recently read an article by three Hindu biologists arguing passionately for the intelligent design of the human cardiovascular system. Their designer is not a member, or it's not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I think as you look globally, you're going to find tremendous variety and disagreement, in fact, about who the designer is. So perhaps in the United States that's true. It's not true internationally.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, you have been so helpful. We recommend both of your books, Saving Darwin and Explore Evolution. We invite the audience to pick them up, to re-listen to these broadcasts on their podcasts or iTunes or just by visiting our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our Darwin Day discussion on The Things That Matter Most. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. We're always interested in making our show better, and you, our listeners, can play a role. We'd like your feedback on what you like about our show and what you think can be better. You can give us your insights by going to thethingsthatmattermost.org or by sending us an email at info@thethingsthatmattermost.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we've been talking with Paul Nelson and Carl Giberson about evolution. Where is the evidence for, we know there's a lot of evidence for the small microevolution, bacteria becoming resistant to new medicines, but where is the evidence for the large changes that a reptile can become a bird? And one of the things we didn't have time to talk about, Rick, I thought was so great, and it gives such a great example of the humor in the book. It talks about the complexity of a flagellum motor and how can a cell build it itself. And of course, the answer that's being given that Paul goes into in the book is, well, you get simpler structures in the shell, like they point to a pump that some organisms use and say, see, you can take the proteins that are in this pump and they show up again in the flagellar motif. And so you just have an organism co-opting one part of its design into a more complex design. And the book says, yeah, well, you may as well hope that half your car's transmission will suddenly help out the airbag department. Mm-hmm. And so it's very readable. It does a great job of laying out some of the evidence and the counter evidence. And I would just encourage any parent that's looking for a resource to really discuss this with their child. I think you would find it very helpful to deal with high schoolers, college kids, just general reading. Highly recommend.
Okay, well, that's a wrap, and we're going into another busy week with lots of things to keep our minds entirely occupied, but it's the kinds of questions that we ask on this show that, in the end, are going to be the most important, so let's not get so busy this week that we don't take time to think about the things that matter most.